Well, hey there, and welcome to episode number 64 of Groove, the No Trouble podcast, which you can always find at notrouble.com. My name is Mitch Joel, but before we get started, I just want to let you know that a lot of these conversations that we get the privilege to record, they obviously don't happen the day that we're publishing the show. And in the case of this conversation, and perhaps the next one and the one after, they were recorded a little bit before we hit this crazy pandemic that we know as COVID-19. So if there's no mention of it, if we're talking about tour dates or what's coming up this year, that stuff may have changed. And I just wanted to be fair and let you as the listener and as part of the No Trouble community know that. And with that, I just want to hope and pray that all of you are safe, are healthy, that you are staying inside, following the instructions for wherever you may live, and that we can sort of get past this so that we can get to a new groove, a place where we can see shows again, which I cannot wait to do, and experience live music and play live music. So stay strong, my fellow electric bass and bass playing community members. And with that, let's get on with the show. So who are you and what do you do?
My name is Joe Ayoub, and I am a bass player here in Los Angeles, California, where I am right now.
Yeah, and things have been getting pretty busy for you lately, I feel.
They have, yes. They have. Thank God they have been busy, which is good. It's, you know, musician life is always this sort of feast or famine kind of lifestyle, but things have been good. So no complaints here.
I don't know where I want to start with you, if it's like chronologically from like now backwards or from the beginning forwards, but let's just put out there that the sort of cool big thing you're working on right now is you are the bass player on American Idol, which is pretty amazing.
Yes. Yes. Which is very amazing. And we're in the middle of our, so it went off the air for a little while and changed networks. It was on Fox and then it changed to ABC. When it changed to ABC, there was a lot of changes and a whole new band. And that's when this particular band that's on it now started. And now, so we're in our, it's strange to say, but we're in our third season, but the show's in its, like, I don't know, 16th, 17th, 18th season, something crazy like that. But for this group of people, it's our third season.
So for those who might have dropped off or just aren't paying attention, who are the judges? Like, who are the names that we know?
Yeah, when it went back on the air on ABC, the new judges were Katy Perry, Lionel Richie, and Luke Bryan, and they have been the same these past three seasons. So the two past ones and this current one.
So I thought I wanted to start with your origin story, but I don't. I want to go down the American Idol path. So talk about what happens. Like, how do you get this call? Who do you know? How does this gig land in your lap?
So the Katy Perry's musical director is a man I've known for a long time. One of the first people I met when I moved to LA 16 years ago. And his name is Chris Pooley. And he's sort of musical director to the stars. He's worked with everyone, both as a piano player and a keyboard player and a musical director, and really, really went deep down the musical directing hole and put shows together and sends them on their way. Well, anyway, when the show got picked up again, he was asked to do it, and he thankfully asked me to be a part of it, which is great. So it's actually an interesting part of my story, because my first tour when I moved to LA was with him, and now, and we hadn't seen each other in a long time in between, and now we're working together again, which is such a pleasure for me.
So is this an audition scenario? Is it like, I know you, it's fine, you're in? What's the process like?
Yeah, he kind of handpicked who he wanted. It's an interesting gig because you kind of have to wear a lot of hats. And so for me, it's like, you know, electric bass, upright bass, keyboard bass. There's all the usual sort of like, know how to operate in this fast paced gig where changes are happening constantly. we might get a new chart tossed on our music stand immediately with a new key. And I think he just picked people that have sort of grown up playing that sort of way and adapting, and it's not for everybody. So I think he kind of handpicked who he thought could handle this gig and can move at this sort of fast pace in that sort of environment, you know?
Is it one of those things where you like wipe your brow, like, oh, I don't have to audition, that's so good?
Yes. It's the greatest thing. It's the greatest compliment to not have to audition. And when someone just hires you, whether it's a tour or a show like this or any sort of gig, because there's just a level of trust there that is, it's flattering that someone trusts you, in that position. So yes, it definitely is great to not have to audition. I don't mind auditioning. I feel like I'm pretty comfortable auditioning. You know, you do it so many times that you just know, you learn the songs inside out, or you know, spend a lot of time on whatever you're going into and do your research, and you audition, and they're going to pick who they think is right for the gig. So I don't mind it, but it's always a compliment to not have to.
What's the work schedule like? I mean, you know, we just see like a season on TV, but like, what is the actual work cycle like when you have to do a season of American Idol?
It's kind of broken up into two halves, and the first half of the season are a lot of pre-tapes. So what we'll do is the first batch, I believe, is I don't even know how many tunes now, like 70 tunes or 80 tunes. It's interesting because the season gets easier as it goes on. It starts at its hardest. The first Hollywood week is the hardest week for all the musicians, because there's just so many songs and so many kids auditioning, and it moves so fast that the more they get whittled down, you know, the arrangements get longer. They're more involved. You have a little more time to breathe. So actually, it keeps getting better as the season comes to a close, not harder. You would think it'd be the other way around. But at the beginning, the first few episodes are pre-taped with the band because they're earlier in the season. And then the second half is when the live shows start. That's when it's live, like it's live to both coasts. So everybody's getting it live. So that's kind of the more high pressure situation. Those are our shows, and when it's go time, it's go time, and there's no going back.
Crazy. And how does it work in terms of like timing? So like clearly things change. An artist or someone auditioning wants to change, you know, the whatever it might be, you change an arrangement. But do you have like enough lead time to make this work, or is it actually stressful, or are you just kind of one of those people now where it is what it is, and if they throw the sheet or chart in front of you live, it's going to be what it's going to be?
Oh, they wouldn't. It wouldn't be a complete. It would. I mean, there's been some close calls, but if someone wanted to change something super last minute, I don't even know that they would be allowed to. It's just too dangerous, and no one wants to put them in that position, you know, to go on live TV and have to scrape something together. So we definitely get time with the kids to rehearse an arrangement, you know, agree on an arrangement, rehearse an arrangement, maybe tweak it to their liking, or if they want to change little parts here and there. But once you do the dress rehearsal, at least it's going to stay there. No one's going to change the key after the dress rehearsal. You just can't. Yeah. I think there's rules behind that, because remember, it's a competition. So there are a lot of rules that they have to abide by.
So you take a gig, you're a working musician, you want these gigs, and like American Idol, just reality shows in general, competitions have such a stigma, or I shouldn't say stigma, there's like, they're polarized. It's like, they're people who are like, this is really good, we got all these new voices and all these new characters, and then there are people on the other side who are like, this is like why the music industry is where it is. Is it like, do you sort of put morals into, like, do you think about like, yeah, should I be doing American Idol? Like, is that, or are you like, this is a great gig, like I want to be involved in great gigs?
Yeah. I mean, my thought is it's a great gig, and I like being involved in great gigs. Exactly like you said, with great musicians at a high level. Look, if you're tuning into American Idol and expecting, you know, the new Radiohead album to come, it's like everything. There's a place for everything, and I've never kind of. I grew up and I studied jazz in college, and there is a lot of snobbery all over the place in every genre. And I really just try to meet everything at where it is and what it is. So to me, this is I love it. I absolutely love it. I get to play with some of my favorite musicians who are in the band. The energy is insane because these kids, it's their shot.
Yeah, it's like know? Life or death like, for them.
Yeah, it's like life or death, and you want to do right by them and play a great arrangement for them. And to see, and some of them are so brave. I mean, to sing in front of millions of people, and you know, sometimes they're teenagers who never had a gig before, and it's incredible, like the talent that you see. It's a different thing. Yeah, it's not like a singer-songwriter. Well, some of them are singer-songwriters that have been doing it for a long time.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, I would say don't judge a book by its cover. But if it's not your thing, then, you know, you're not watching it anyway.
Yeah, it's right? Funny. When I saw that, my genuine reaction was, you know, the path to figuring this out is so not linear. And that we tend to look at people who become famous as they sort of did this, this, and this, and we fail to realize it is something like a lottery. And it's something, there's a lot of luck, and there's a lot of other stuff that happens. And it's unfortunately not a meritocracy. Like, people who are super amazing musicians that you and I know just never had a break. I mean, my whole thing was, there were bands that got signed to major labels with the best management, hired the best producers back in the 80s and 90s, and the albums were amazing, and just it didn't click, it didn't go. And so when I look back on it, I'm sort of more like, so that was their shot. Like, why is that any different than somebody picking up a track off of SoundCloud? Like, I just never understood the gripe with it.
Yeah, and they have to deliver. Like, Kelly Clarkson, I mean, she has her own show now. You know, what is this like?
The entertainer she became, yeah.
Yeah, and people love her, and they love her story, and they love her voice. And I don't know, is that – I think everyone can get a shot or a free ride or a ticket, but to sustain it, that's on you. You know what I mean? Yeah. To say that she just got lucky and that was it. Well, no, she's a massive celebrity, you know, and you have to be able to sustain that. And clearly there's something about her that people relate to, that's my whole thing. It's like, break it down to the simplest form. Everyone always wants to critique music, especially like, this is trash, but this is good. And it doesn't make any sense to me, because if it moves you, if it touches that place in your soul and inspires you, or makes you feel a little bit better when you were sad, or helps you get through something, then it did its job, no matter what it is. You know what I mean?
I had the same reaction. A friend was telling me that I should watch the Taylor Swift documentary on Netflix. And I, again, no real connection to her other than knowing she's super famous and probably being able to go, oh, that was one of her songs. Okay. And I really had the exact same reaction to everything you were just saying was my reaction to the movie, which was just like, it's unbelievable in a day and age where music like that has become somewhat disposable, that she was able to not just sustain, but like grow and get the stadium tours and get political or whatever she's doing. And people are quick to take shots at her for her looks, for her songs, for everything else. But it's just an unheard of thing to have that type of longevity in that type of genre.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially now when the attention span is so low and things move so quickly, and like, Instagram culture is, we don't even have the patience to watch a video. Now it's whatever, a 15-second clip, and that sort of, and then we're on to the next one, you know?
Yeah, it's crazy. So let's dig into your origin story. I prepare for these conversations. I sort of dig in, look online, listen to music, watch videos. And I would say that I sort of came back from trying to figure out who you are, Joe, and thought and realized, like, I don't know much. Like, you're a bit of a ghost online. when did you first pick up the bass?
I first started playing in about seventh grade. I was... I always loved the drums and ended up playing drums in a few bands in high school and stuff. But when I was in elementary school, you know, they ask you what you want to play. I wanted to play drums, and I got denied because a dear friend of mine got the drummer slot and I was left playing viola. Right. So then I was like, okay, I'm not really into this. So later in middle school, it just kind of became time to really pick my instrument again, as far as not in school, but at home. And I have an older brother who's a year and a half older than me that was a piano player, singer, and played guitar. And it was like this drum thing came up for me. And I was like, I want to play drums. I feel like it's in my blood. And we had a friend from church who played drums, and my brother said, look, if you play bass, we can be in a band, because then we got three guys and it'll complete it. And then for some reason, being in a band sounded cooler than whatever instrument it was going to be.
Exactly.
So I was like, the greatest gift he ever could have given me was to suggest that I should play bass. And I took to it right away. So he learned the Suzuki method. Are you familiar
sure,
with that?
Of course, yeah.
Okay, so it was all ear training. So as a kid, my brother Nick, his name is Nick, he's a judge now, which is crazy, but he still lives in Michigan and is married with a kid, but still gigs all the time. Just a brilliant musician, like light years ahead of me. And he learned Suzuki. So he was just able to figure out pop tunes as a little kid on piano. He would just bang them out. He would just listen to them, hear the changes, like learned harmony. And so by the time I was playing, he could teach me, and he would sit me down and say, okay, listen, do you hear that? Try to pick out your part, try to pick out the bass line. And I remember there were two records, the two most influential records. There's this Jackson 5, Diana Ross, record that our mom had, that the bass is just so funky, and the Fifth Dimension Aquarius Let the Sunshine In record. I can't remember the name of the actual record, but that song was on it, and that song, of course, as we know now, is Joe Osborne on bass, and it's a incredible bass. But these songs and these records really sort of like made me go, oh, this is the bass. I hear it. I know what it does. I know its role. And I just kind of got it really early. And I think it's because this sort of like ear training, figure it out, use your ears, hum it first, and then try and play it back, sort of way that he taught me how to play. And then at that time was, I think Nevermind came out like right around there. And, you know, next thing I know, we're in a basement with our other friend playing Smells Like Teen Spirit, you know, like working our way through it.
It's funny when, if I think of like Jackson 5, Diana Ross, and Fifth Dimension, I'm like, oh, now I get the hair. Now I get where you get the hair from.
Right? it's in there.
It's just a tribute to it right there. It's funny. It's so funny how like some stories are really similar. Like my brother was 3 years older than me, guitarist, and same thing. It's just like, it seemed so complex to me. And I just felt like the bass might be simpler. It was a mistake, but I did. And he's a criminologist now. So there you go. So we have like,
oh, wow. There you are. Yeah.
Weird,
awesome.
Yeah. It's like a weird, like I always hear these weird stories from bass players. And I'm like, as unique as these stories are, there's always this sort of red thread that goes through all of our lives. So at what point are you like, well, this is now my profession. I'm going to take this as a serious gig. This is my life. This is what I'm doing.
Well, what's interesting is how, life sort of dictates that. So I was saying that, so I took it up in seventh grade. Seventh grade was actually, middle school was really difficult for me because I had this great experience growing up. I have a, you know, great family, friends and community around. But once I hit middle school, I went to this public school that was kind of rough. And for my happy utopia sort of turned into, it was just a tough experience for me, middle school. And at the same time, that's when the music bug hit. So it was just a perfect sort of like outlet and gave me all this hope for the future and something to sink my teeth into. I really think that is what pushed it over the edge and made it, I don't want to say an obsession because that sounds negative, but a passion of mine. So from then on, it kind of got me through middle school and gave me hope for a future and something better. So once it hit, you know what else really did it was this idea of community, like getting in a room with other people and working out a song and then playing it was to me the greatest thing. And people usually say, well, once they were in front of an audience, they get the bug. For me, like rehearsing was the bug. It was just unbelievable that like, oh, all the elements are here and here's the drummer and he's a friend. Like when we first started to jam in a room together, that for me, that was everything. And it also felt like, you know, there's so much camaraderie and I felt like a team with these people. And I think it's interesting that bass being the role that it is, I've always been in love with that sort of like being a piece of the puzzle, being a part of something bigger. And that's what I loved. And I think that's what I fell in love with. And I ran with it. So from then on out, my brother and I started gigging really, really early. I think my first gig was Grease the Musical. And it was the high school production, but they had to pay me because I was still in middle school. I was in eighth grade and I technically wasn't a student there yet. So I did this whole run of this musical and they wrote me a check for $100 at the end. And I just thought I hit the jackpot. It was I just couldn't believe I got paid to do that. And it was the greatest experience of my life. You know what I mean?
It's crazy. It's crazy because at the time, I mean, you're 12, 13 years old. Like that's pretty young.
Yeah. And again, I have to attribute it all to having an older brother who like, pushed through you, and then and he was the piano player singer, so he was just this sort of young phenom that would go play a gig, go play Piano Man, and everyone would lose it, you know, because it was so great. And he would always bring me with him, like, okay, he's gonna play, okay, I'm gonna bring my brother and we're gonna play and bring a drummer and, you know, we'll play your backyard graduation party or whatever. And you know, half of the time we forget to ask what it pays. We didn't even care. We were just trying to gig as much as we could.
It's a funny thing too that like I do reflect on the multiple times in my life that happens, whether it was writing or playing music, where it really speaks to the hobby and the craft and the passion and the interest you have. And it's strange when the money gets a bit kooky, how we do change as people. Like I always think about, like I used to write and write. Now someone's like, hey, can you write an article? I'm like, oh, let's see, probably you're going to pay me. You know, like it's crazy how like we really change in weird ways. It's so funny. And I sometimes miss those simple times of like not asking how much, cause you were just so excited. Someone wanted you there.
It's like, yeah, you didn't even care. It was like a bonus. Like if we got paid, it'd be like, really? And if they were going to pay us, we would never, ever, when we were teenagers, have the nerve to be like, how much? We would never ask that. We'd be like, okay, cool, you're going to pay us. Whatever we get is whatever we get, you know?
And so you and your brother continue, but at one point this band or this working together stops. He goes off to become a judge. When does that sort of, I'll call it the bigger break, which is the moment where it's a real name, it's a real band, something hits. What was that moment for you?
Okay, so then through all that, and then playing through multiple bands in high school and doing that, so just trying to absorb everything I could. Then I went to college, and I studied at Western Michigan University. So a lot of upright bass, and a lot of, you know, I played in the orchestra and did that whole thing. And when school ended, it was sort of that time, okay, now what? You know, I knew it was kind of a, back then there was this mindset that, you know, if you don't go to college, life is going to be harder on you. I didn't really want to go to school, to be honest, but it was just sort of ingrained in me that no matter what you do, you should probably go to college. And I don't think that's necessarily the case. It wasn't back then and it isn't now, but I am thankful that I did go because I learned so much there. But I knew if I was going to go to college and I was going to make it through, because I'm an awful student, I knew if I'm going to do it, I might as well do something that I love and worry about the consequences later, which is exactly what I did. So after college, the initial move that a great guitar player in town here, Brett Farkas, who's a dear friend of mine, we were going to move and sort of a musical soulmate. We were into the same sort of music and we were in bands together, and we were going to move to Chicago, and it's a very sort of easy move when you're in the Midwest, because I was from Grand Rapids, Michigan. We went to school in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and Chicago's about 2.5 hours away, and we already had a network of musicians there. So Brett and I were like, yeah, let's do it together. We're going to move to Chicago and then maybe eventually look into a bigger city. Well, what happened was that the apartment we went to get, we got a phone call that it was a mistake and this apartment isn't available anymore. And for some reason, I had some personal things going on in my life, and maybe Brett wasn't convinced by it either, but we put the whole thing on hold. And then we sort of just like revisited it months later, as months were going by. I was still living at home in Grand Rapids, and he had done the Mancini Institute during the summer years of college, which was like this great institute out here in LA for college musicians. So he had already gotten the LA bug a little bit, and he was the one that was like, you know what, we need to think bigger. Like, why Chicago? Let's go straight to LA. That's exactly what we want to do. We wanted to get on tours and play with artists and be in bands and do that sort of thing. It just seemed like LA was the right move. I don't think I would have had the guts to do it if he wasn't pushing it so hard, but when he suggested it, it seemed a little far-fetched, but then it just started to make more sense. And we were like, you know what, let's do it. So we moved to LA in 2000, end of 2003. And within, I would say probably 6 months, I got my first tour. And then from then on out, it just sort of started to snowball. So anytime anyone asks, hey, how'd you get started or whatever, the biggest thing, the number one thing was being here, was being in LA where these things happen.
So always. Which is the first? Is that Liz Phair?
Liz Phair was the first tour, yep.
So I mean, nice to say, moved to LA late 2003, early 2004, 6 months later, I'm on tour with Liz Phair. Is it networking? Is it playing clubs? Is it just sort of working networks? Is it all of that? What got to Liz Phair saying, I like this guy, Joe?
Well, at that time, there was a guy in town. He's still here. His name is Barry Squire, and he would hold these auditions for record companies or for bands who needed players for touring bands, and they were happening all the time. It seemed like when we arrived, it was just a good time for that sort of thing. So, per other people's advice, I got a hold of him and just tried to get in his Rolodex to let me know if there's any auditions that were happening. And my first audition was for a band called The Calling. Do you remember The Calling?
I do, yeah, sure.
Okay, yep. And I just got lucky. He was like, okay, newbie to town, sure, I'll put you on this audition. So I went and auditioned for, I was so green. I brought like a folder with like a headshot and like a resume. I didn't know, you know, I was like, is this what you're supposed to do? He laughed at me when I gave it to him, not in a mean way, in a just sort of like, oh, okay, I've never seen this before.
This is not required, but thank you.
Yeah. And man, I learned the hell out of those songs. Like, every bar, like every detail, because I just didn't know what it entailed. I didn't know that should I just get the ethos of the song, or do I need to, every note length should be exact? I don't know. So that's what I did. And it was a good audition. Unfortunately, I did not get the gig, but Barry felt like I did a good job, and he suggested me for the Liz Phair audition. Now, a few months earlier, after I moved, I had recently met Chris Pooley through Brett, who he knew him through a bunch of Michigan friends, because those are all Michigan guys too.
So the callback to Chris Pooley, who is the keyboard player, musical director for Katy Perry and American Idol, which is how you got to American Idol. Go.
Correct. Yes, correct. So I met him, and he still makes fun of me for this to this day, but I gave him my card.
Which you with the cards and the headshots.
Yes, I
Were
know.
Were you trying to be a model or a musician?
I just didn't know. I was just figuring it out. So when they were like, well, we need a bass player for this tour, because he was on it. He was the keyboard player. And he had just mentioned, hey, I just met this guy here. His card's in my pocket. So I got suggested by Barry Squire, and Chris mentioned me. So I was coming from two places into this audition, which was, I think, helpful. And so I went and did that audition. I don't think I did as well as I did in the Calling audition, but I got through it. And I met Liz, and I met Dino Menigan, who was the musical director, and they were super sweet. And a couple days later, I got the call that you got the gig and we're going on tour. And I was just super stoked. I think Liz also probably saw on me that I was green and new to town and maybe moldable, you know, like someone who isn't jaded, or I was bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, and I think she probably sensed that and thought it would be a good person, you know, to have on the bus and to sort of like mold into what they wanted in that particular band. Oh man, I had so much fun with them. It was great.
So
it's so great.
It's interesting to hear your story, because a lot of times people take gigs like this in between having their own band, in between wanting to do a solo album. But it seems like you had this thing in you, like from early days, like almost like this hired gun. Like, I just want to play and be paid to play. And again, no judgment. I think that's an amazing thing. Is that true? Or were you still like, I wish it was my own band, or I wish I was doing this?
I loved that you got a variety of things as a sideman, even though I didn't even know the term sideman when I was doing it in Michigan, but I was playing with blues bands and rock bands and cover bands and all of it in this heavy rotation of different things. And it was sidemanning. And one band I don't think at that time necessarily satisfied. It didn't satisfy me. I was so hungry for different types of music and wanting to play it all and be playing all the time. So it just happened naturally. I didn't even think about that as a thing. And in some ways it got me in trouble playing in original bands, because when you're in an original band, your other band members don't want you to be in another band. You know what I mean? So it did cause some problems early on, but it was very natural for me to want to do many things. And I revered all the, you know, studio guys and this idea of playing on a lot of different records and what the session guys were doing. I think I just loved it and fell in love with it and wanted to be a part of everything. It always starts, I think, the spark as this idea of being in a band. And I would love to be in a band and write records and do that sort of thing. But it's also sort of, I like the idea of that, but I also love what I do too. So I don't know. It's all in there. It's all in there. I mean, it'd be great to be whatever in the Red Hot Chili Peppers or the Foo Fighters or something and just be in the band. But I just, you know, it hasn't worked out like that for me.
Yeah, the big names that you've played with, it really speaks to like the way sessions, I guess, move and flow or your network, because it's like Liz Phair, it's Shakira. You were on the Carson Daly, in the Carson Daly house band, Enrique Iglesias, Leonard Cohen. Let's talk about Leonard Cohen. I mean, here I sit in Montreal, home to Leonard Cohen. So,
oh, there you go.
Let's talk about Leonard. How did that happen? What was that gig? When was that? What was it like?
I played on one of his records.
Okay.
And I actually never got a chance to meet him, unfortunately.
Most of them, yeah.
I know. Yeah. But the producer of the record was Patrick Leonard, and great, fantastic musician and producer. But I knew his engineer, who I'd done a lot of work for, Jesse String. And when they needed a bass player to come in, Jesse suggested me to Patrick. And I just went over to Patrick's house and we did a bunch of the tracking there. And it was a blast. He had these great like mock-ups of what the music was going to be. And it was tough because I guess Leonard Cohen loves the simplicity of these sort of MIDI tracks. So the idea was to... It was about playing simply and, you know, making way for his incredible lyrics and melodies. And yeah, so really, really, really cool experience. I wish I could have met him, but, you know.
Yeah, I don't know if I've told this story on the show before, but where he lives in Montreal, there's a little park across the street, and it's actually on a fairly well-known street in Montreal called St. Laurent Boulevard. And his home is sort of like a duplex, triplex, so it's like a two or three floor. And on the bottom floor, there's like this sort of monastery-ish like meditation thing. And I'm making it sound bigger than it is. It's a really small little house. And across the street from this park on the other side is a restaurant called Bagels, etc. And I happen to know the owner, and I go down there all the time, and we're friends. And that's where Leonard would actually go in and like sit and have a coffee in the morning and talk to these guys, these owners. And I sit in the bench, and like his name is actually there. Like all the frequent people who eat there, like their names are up on next to the seats where they sat, and they actually recently renovated. And the chair where he sat at the bar having his morning coffee, they left as the original, that chair, which is
that's cool.
And when I have friends who are musicians and they're in town, I usually take them there for breakfast. I don't tell them what it is, and then after I go, we should grab a picture, and I just sort of do it in front of the house, and then I tell them, turn around, that's Leonard Cohen's house, and they're always like, oh my god, that's the craziest. It's a fun experience because they have no idea where they are, and it's such an amazing thing to. He really is tied to this city. So in a very strange way, because he actually spent most of his time closer to where you live than he did over here towards, you know, most of his life in the end. So, yeah.
Wow. Amazing, very cool.
Amazing guy. The other thing that really struck me is that's a wild story is when I was Googling you, you were playing in Bulgaria with Enrique Iglesias. And you got attacked.
Oh, yes.
It's like there's so little on you, but I'm like, oh my god, attacked in Bulgaria, like that's not the gig you want. That's insane.
Yeah, that story kind of got out of hand. I was walking with my bandmates, and yeah, we did. We got jumped. And later we found out that there was a big sort of nationalist movement happening, and it could have been because, you know, we looked like we didn't belong there, or maybe they heard us speaking English. But yeah, we got jumped, and Celia, one of the singers that was with us, posted, you know, it was traumatic at the time. Everyone was okay, but it was just, you know, just ruffled our feathers a bit, and she had posted something on social media about it, and then the press there kind of ran with it, and that's what shows up when you Google us now. Yeah. So
it's a weird thing too. Like it's such a, one is it's a scary thing, and two, it's like you're sort of like an employee and you're working. It's like the last thing you want to be is like in the media for that with that artist. You know, it's like it's brutal.
Yeah. I think they ran with it, but yeah, it was scary, but man, that place is beautiful. I went sightseeing the next day. It was just one of those isolated incidents, unfortunate incidents that, you know, that happens sometimes when you travel a lot. I'm surprised, as much as, you know, as we all have traveled, that was kind of the only one like that, you know?
So
I've been lucky.
Was that a long tour with Enrique? Like what was, out of all the bands that we've talked about, were there ones where it's like multiple years and multiple tours, or is it mostly like a one tour, couple month gig for you?
Well, no, Enrique especially, I was with him, you know, over 10 years.
Oh, wow.
He's interesting because a lot of artists, especially now since the industry is so different, there's not necessarily an album cycle, but it used to be an album, you know, you put out an album and then you tour that album for a couple years and then you maybe take a long break and go do another album where the musicians would go find another gig because they're not going to be working for a while. Enrique, since I've started, like he just keeps going, and it's not necessarily like full, you know, 2 month runs or something, but he just always had a steady stream of work on the calendar, which is great for all of us. So yeah. The gig sort of just kept going, and the years were going by and we were all still working, and it, you know, he'd do I think with an artist like that, he's so global that, you know, by the time you're going to come back around, you know, a few years have gone by and you can just do it again.
Yeah. It's amazing. I mean, but like, don't realize how good those gigs are. Like those are just great gigs, you know?
Yes. Great gigs. And that's why, you know, and just a really fun band and a fun bunch of people to be around. And yeah. Well, and he did, you know, he does so many privates too. It's not just necessarily tours.
For sure.
And he can go anywhere and play and get an audience.
Yeah, the corporate gigs are awesome. So what you were talking about fun, I mean, one of the things that I definitely loved rabbit holing on the internet was Scary Pockets. So what is this, like, you're called in for this? Is Scary Pockets like is it your band? What is it?
It's so funny that I love that you asked it like that, because that's how everyone asked it. Like, oh,
it's hard to know. Band,
yeah. Scary Pockets. I'm like, oh no, I did. Well, basically, Jack and Ryan are Scary Pockets. It's the guitar player and the keyboard player.
Okay.
And it's really the two of them, and everything else is it's a collective.
It's like,
and they had this idea. Yeah. So that's why there's so many different people on there. So. Or last year, I got a text. I knew who Ryan was. We'd never met, and he had heard of me, same sort of thing. And he texted me and was like, "Hey, do you want to come do this
thing?"
This thing I'm doing, like, Scary Pockets. So and like, I heard of it.
It's a song. It's a cover. It's really, I guess it's really a shot for YouTube. Is that the right sort of way to explain the project?
Yeah, I guess you could say it's for content. And but they also release the music on Spotify,
right.
And it's really cool. I mean, in a world where everything is sort of pieced together in the computer, they gather great musicians in town, put them in a room, and you know, they pick a song beforehand and basically come up with a cool little arrangement on the fly where everyone contributes ideas. And within an hour, they shoot it, and don't overthink it. And it's really fun, really cool. And I think a lot of them have turned out really well. That's why they're so popular. I think they're touring right now. But it's a collective. There's two guys, and everyone else is sort of like, and they mix it up. So
good
tons of great bass players who have done it.
I'll recommend as a great gateway to seeing Joe and Scary Pockets. For me, it was Let's Stay Together. That one just sort of was great.
Oh, cool.
And also, you know, I don't know Ryan, but send them my regards on that Eric Clapton t-shirt, because I was also just like, oh, that's a great t-shirt he was wearing. He's wearing a killer Eric Clapton t-shirt. That's all I'm going to say. It's great.
The old rock and roll t-shirts are cool.
Yeah, those baseball.
They're pricey now.
They're so good. So great. So before we cut out, I'd love to know, I mean, you talked a little bit about the people you play with. You talked a little bit about Jackson 5, Diana Ross, Fifth Dimensions, and Nevermind, Nirvana. Who are the actual bass players that – I guess really inspired you to be a pro? And are there any others that just sort of over time have sort of trickled in and have changed the way you think about playing? I mean, the way you play for me is just so interesting. It's diverse and you play different genres, but you have this very unique attack. That's just, it's a real likable sound that you create.
Oh, thank you. That's really sweet of you to say that. I've always loved, I always loved songs first. So the bass players were secondary. So I think I just grew up loving pop music and vocal music and everything, you know, like the Beatles and Simon and Garfunkel and everything, Billy Joel, Elton John. I grew up on all this great, you know, music that we all grew up on. So I think most of the bass players are ones from classic albums, you know what I mean? And all the stand, I love Paul McCartney. I love, you know, Dee Murray, who played with Elton John. I love Jamerson. I love, and then I, you know, like all bass players do, you get into Jaco and you, you know, Victor Wooten, or you know, but really the song craftsmen, those are the guys I love. Where, you know, that one note in the last chorus that just elevated it a little bit. Those are the things I fell in love with, because I'm kind of, you know, I mean, I'm super particular and I kind of OCD, so. I would just study this stuff and dig in and like, why does this last chorus feel that much more intense? Oh, just because he added a 16th note here, or he put a third in the bass here, and it just took it to the next level.
That's my fascination right there. And I'm not as musical as you, but that's my fascination with Pino Palladino.
Oh yeah, Pino. Love Pino. Love, 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 love.
Like I can't. If you ask me to explain it to you, I can't explain why I like him. I can't explain why he's all that great. And in fact, in many instances, he's very much almost behind the groove a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But he's got this thing where I'm just like, yeah, I just kind of like anything he plays on in this weird way.
Yeah, and it's what he does to the music, and that's I think that's what I've right. always loved that's and wanted to do is what yeah what that contribution does to the music and its bass, and sometimes it sticks out, sometimes it doesn't, but it should always be elevating things, and he's a master at that. That's why he's on so much stuff, and that's the perfect example. Is just figuring out in every section of a song how to make it move and how to make it that much better. And it, a lot, you know, most people don't notice, but the ones who do are in awe. I always think about that about drummers. Like sometimes certain drummers, before you get to play with them, you know, you're a little like, I don't really get what the special is with this guy. You know what I mean? Especially when there's so many great drummers, I don't get the special. And then you play with them and you're, oh, I get the special now. You know, sometimes you have to feel it from a different perspective. And same with bass. There's a lot of great bass players in town that I think other bass players are angry, like, why does that guy work so much? What's so special about him? And you're not paying attention. It's really, really special. And what he does to a song is special. But it's not flashy, you know?
Yeah, it's such an interesting bass. It's an interesting instrument, and how it's used in both the way you're saying, and I think even as a solo instrument these days, it really brings out this whole new color of music it's so interesting to hear. I can't thank you enough for your time, Joe. It was amazing talking to you. People can check you out obviously by just watching the current season of American Idol. Let people know where else they might be able to connect with you. You're on Facebook. You're doing stuff on Facebook that I do see. Let people know where they can best connect you and learn out more about what's going on in your world.
Yeah, I'm really not great at social media. I should be better, but I am on Facebook. It's just under Joe Ayoub, and I'm on Instagram, Joseph Abraham Ayoub, but I'm not a big poster, so forgive me. But usually,
it's sparse, but it's fine. YouTube is also a great place. There's a lot of people grabbing clips, you putting stuff up, so YouTube's pretty good too.
There you go. Okay, cool.
Hey Joe, thank you so much for your time.
Mitch, I appreciate it.